10748, rule 14.
Colonel Ismail Khan, rule 14.
Captain Parab, as I mentioned, he escaped and he got an MC, and Pritam Singh got an MC. They're very good awards. I mean, they were in a very daring escape. After throughout the main, I mean, going along the mainland of Malaya to Maiduguri Archipelago, then Burma, and then finally reaching India on their own without having recourse to joining the INF fighting forces. Though many people who joined the INF forces got back to India, they were exonerated, but they were never given any other jobs than that later in the army. But one Subedar, who from 1st 14 Punjab Regiment, who had joined the INA with Mohan Singh, got back to India in 1943 and conveyed to the intelligence director in GHQ, among other things, that I was also alive. Because my family had got the news I was missing, believed to be prisoner. Much earlier fighting in Malaya. So finally they got the news that I was alive and I was in a concentration kind of a camp. That was in July 42. Now that was the end of the story of the INA and their antics and the reactions they caused in India. Funny enough, this Captain Parab that I just mentioned, where later on in 1948, October, November, when I arrived in the outskirts of Leh, as Sen Commander of the Gilgit Scouts and Area Commander for Ladakh and Zojila and Baltistan, I was surrounding Leh. I was sleeping 7 miles away from Leh in a village called Dimu in the Buddhist area. And Parab was then commanding a battalion of the 8th Gurkhas. And one of his saying, I think it was his same command called Mathur, whom I mentioned earlier that his brother was executed by Japanese. After the ceasefire, he sent him to meet me. I was the commander in that area after the ceasefire about March 1949. And I wish I had seen him. I was very fond of Parab. He was a quiet little Maratha, but full of guts. And his battalion, when I withdrew from Leh, they were chasing me. But I never gave them a battle. I just kept running. And apart from a couple of ambushes, I got away with my 450 men. And I took up positions in a place called Marol, on the bank of the Indus River, and north of Kargil, or the Kargil River to the right. I took up positions there till the ceasefire. So that is how the prisoner of war days came back, then partition, and then all that took place.
There was a lot of support for Subhas Chandra Bose from the Hindus. What did the Muslims think of him?
Nothing practically. Apart from the pseudo-intellectuals who are going for Congress and things like that, the people of who had joined the Indian National Army. Subhas Chandra Bose, as you know, he was an Indian civil service officer under the British, which is a very high-grade service. It was called the Imperial Services of India. And a brilliant officer, by all the reports that I'd heard, read about him. Then he resigned and joined the Congress. At one time he became the president of the All India Congress. But he fell out with Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru. He was more militant in his view. Militant, and he wanted really bloodshed and fighting to get independence. In 1941, I heard, later on when I returned from the war, people told me in Peshawar that he had escaped from jail somewhere in Bengal, central India. And he found his way to Peshawar, where Pathan Congressites, the red shirts, Khan Ghaffar Khan and Khan Sahib and their brothers, you know, whose son is now Wali Khan, still a politician in India and Pakistan. They helped him to get away through Afghanistan.
Could I ask you about the red shirts and Ghaffar Khan? Can you tell me, from your personal knowledge, what kind of support he had in those days in Northwest Frontier Province?
Tremendous support. About late 20s, very late, about 28, 27, 28, 29, 30, they raised a red shirt movement, a red shirt movement. They wore red shirts, like bushers, and red shorts, and red stockings, and chaplis, you know, the frontier kind of a sandal, very tough.
Did you see them yourself?
Yes, very much. Khan Sahib, his elder brother, was an IMS captain, Indian Medical Services captain. He was a student in England, medical student. He joined the army. I heard that he as a nursing orderly. He fought in during the World War I. Then when the World War I finished, he joined, qualified his, from his medical college. I think it must be Edinburgh. Because his wife, he married an English wife here then. And then he was, he joined the medical service and he became a captain. Then he left the medical service as a captain, married an English wife here, and came to the frontier in India, Peshawar area. Khan Sahib was my father's elder brother's class fellow. And his brother, Ghaffar Khan, his younger brother, was also in the same school, Mission High School, Peshawar, where my father was studying too. And we studied later. Khan Sahib was my father's friend from his days of his youth. And naturally, he became our family doctor. His surgery was just about 300 or 400 yards away from our house. And he was our family doctor. And when this red shirt movement started, I used to often visit him with my tonsillitis and things like that, minor illnesses. And I used to go to his surgery. I used to see Ghaffar Khan, his brother. Both the brothers did not get on very well because Khan Sahib was very anglicized. His wife was English. His first wife was a Pathan from his village. And he had a son from her too, called Saadullah Khan. Saadullah. And then from his English wife, he had a daughter and a son, called John, the son, and Miriam, the daughter. Very, very nice man, thorough gentleman, and it was a delight to have known him. I was very fond of him. In 1930, when the Red Shirt Movement, the agitation became more than a nuisance value. There was a mini martial law in Peshawar by the British government, and the red shirts came in for a lot of beating, and they were fired upon during the processions and the agitations. And funny enough, all the wounded and dead were brought right in front of our house. There was a big open area in front of our house in Peshawar. And Khan Sahib's surgery was about 200 or 300 yards up the road. Khan Sahib used to come and treat them there. And he used to come and eat his lunch and his tea for my mother. My mother was very fond of him. And the poor chap, I remember, was very, very upset about the whole thing. And he looked 100% westernized. In summer, he used to wear shorts, stockings, collar and tie, and a jacket. And he used to walk around with his stethoscope. Very, very delightful and popular man. In those days, my father was a DSP in the CID, in the police force. And my father, his boss told him that they are going to arrest Khan Sahib too. So my father couldn't tell him openly, but he told him to watch out. Khan Sahib said he knew that he would be arrested too, along with the rest, because he's helping the dead and wounded. If they want to do it, they're welcome to it. And within a couple of days, Khan Sahib was picked up and arrested. After that, Khan Sahib became Congress, automatically. He was forced into it. If he was not arrested, he wouldn't have joined the Congress. He was in and out of jail. Till 1935, when the British gave certain reforms, I mean, the beginning of home rule kind of a thing, and they had elections. So frontier, whole frontier province, all Pathans, very Hindus and minority, the Congress Party won. And Khansai became the first chief minister of frontier. And he beat Sir Abdul Qayyum, Nawab Sir Abdul Qayyum, a Pathan, who was in the British service, and later he became a great public figure. He founded the Islamic College of Peshawar. Khansai defeated him in 1935. At that time, Khansai was quite young. And Sir Abdul Qayyum, against whom he fought the elections and defeated him, he was 75 years old, I remember. One day I went to visit him with my father, and I was going to college in 1934. So my father said, are you going to fight the elections, Sir Abdul Qayyum? He said, yes, he will fight. But he knows at the age of 75 he'll lose. So what? He's been successful all his life. He'll lose the elections. So Khan Sahib was a great character, and Ghafar Khan was obdurate and obstinate. His intellect was a bit on the lesser degree than his brother Khan Sahib. And after that, during the war, the Congress Ministry stirred, and then they were in and out. Then after the war, 1946, Congress Party again was in power. Khan Sahib was again chief minister. Ghafar Khan was in jail because he was always, his agitation was a bit more violent and virulent. But he was called the Frontier Gandhi. He was called the Frontier Gandhi. And then at the time, when just before partition, Nehru visited Frontier in October 1946. At that time, my battalion was in a place called Malakand on the Frontier. Malakand was famous, made famous by Churchill when he went as war correspondent with Sir Bindon Bludsoe, Ian Hamilton's forces. And he, in his memoirs, mentions how he came across the Pathan with his right shoulder, with his right sword arm in disarray, and the Pathan faced him with a sword. Churchill mentioned in his book that wish he had his sword and his sword arm intact, he could have given him a point or two. But Churchill finally shot him with his pistol. And this was Malakand. And here, my battalion was stationed there. And Nehru came, spent the night in Malakand, in the political agent's house, and was a guest in our mess, Second Baluch mess, officer's mess. And I met Nehru there. Khan Sahib was there. And my company at that time was below Malakand in the plains, down the hills, in a fort called Dargai Fort. There, a Major Yusuf, who later became General Yusuf, famous cavalryman, a friend of Lord Carrington. They were together in cavalry, Indian cavalry, during the war. And he became a High Commissioner of Pakistan and Ambassador of Pakistan here in Britain later. Great chap. He was a major in the 18th Cavalry. He brought his tanks to protect Nehru. He stayed the night with me in the Fort Dargai. In the morning, when Nehru left, and incidentally, at our dinner, I had a little powwow with Nehru about his support of the Indian National Army, which he didn't like very much.
When was this?
In 1946, October. I asked him a question. I said, sir, I read his book called His Experiences with Truth. And he had condemned the Indian prisoners of war who were being exploited by the Germans in the First World War to join the anti-British forces there. And he had mentioned in his book that those people did not represent anybody, and they had no business to negotiate on behalf of India with the Germans. That was in the First World War. So I questioned him. Why did he condemn those which was a beacon light for our action as a prisoners of war, not to join the Japanese, and that he later supported the Indian National Army? I said, I mentioned to him that once when I was being questioned by Japanese Kempo Thai, they questioned me about INA and why didn't I join. So I mentioned Nehru's book to them, in which he said that people outside the country in such circumstances had no business to do anything. Nehru quipped his way out. I said, you know, that day the Japanese Kempo Thai beat me up across my ears So he apologized for being the cause of it. And my CEO's wife, June Featherstone, who died only about 4 or 5 months ago in a home in Kent, took me away, said, "You damn fool, you'll get a letter of severe displeasure by command chief next morning."
Did you?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't. So such stories are very, you know, vivid in my mind. So next morning, Nehru's convoy coming down from Arakan was attacked by a stone-throwing Pathan crowd. And I and General Yusuf protected him. My company was standing too, down on the road in Garday, about 6 miles down the hills. And then General Yusuf took him by his troop of tanks. Instead of on the main road towards Mardan and Peshawar, he diverted the thing on the canal bank, while people all along the route was there waiting to stone him. So General Yusuf took him along the canal route and safely brought him to Peshawar.
Can you now tell me your own personal experiences of the partition?
Yes, because at that time, my battalion, we were in Razmak, in Waziristan. Razmak was in Waziristan, right in the tribal belt. And it was a magnificent camp. In a 1 square mile area, there were 10,000 men, about 1,000 mules and about 150 horses. And a troop of tank and artillery and things like that. And barbed wire camp. So we left Razmak. We were there in Razmak when partition took place. John Harvey Kelly, who is here now, he's from a battalion, he's retired. He lives in Dorset. He was a Major John Harvey Kelly, now is Major Ismail. So just before partition, before the 15th of August, we both decided to go to Kashmir on 10 days leave. And I got an attack of tonsillitis in about 105 degrees temperature. So I couldn't go next morning. And John Amicelli went alone to Kashmir without me, while I spent the time in the hospital. On the 15th of August, we raised the Pakistan flag, simple ceremony, and the Hindu elements began to leave Razma camp, very orderly, and we stayed on, the Muslim elements, and we heard there was a partition. Partition was something which I knew I'd heard about it, but I could never see it as a reality. My mind wasn't on the subject even. So much so that in May 1947, my battalion had moved on from Razmak down to Deir Ismail Khan in the settled areas to protect the Hindus. And there we came under command of a brigade, whose brigade commander was an Indian officer called Brigadier Nathu Singh. He was an old Sandhurst qualified officer. He was a Rajput, big gray moustache, turned up. And when I arrived in Deir Ismail Khan after doing a course in India, arrived there, my CEO said that the brigade commander wanted to see me. When I went to see the brigade commander next morning, Featherstone, my CEO, left me and walked out of the room. And the brigadier asked me to sit down. I sat down and immediately put his ideas to me. He said he is carrying out a research on behalf of Field Marshal Sir Claude Auchinleck, who was the Supreme Commander of India, that he wanted to get the views of the Muslim officers what they thought of the partitioning of the army, because Auchinleck thought of keeping the army as unpartitioned, keep it as a whole, the Indian Army. That was the first time that I had to think about this problem. So I said, I never thought about it that way, but I knew that partition is taking place. And since I come from frontier and lived in Peshawar, so I would automatically join the Pakistan, as my troops in my battalion were three quarters Muslim and one company is Hindu. The Hindus will go to India, we'll stay back here. So I see no point in... He said, did I not think that it would be in the interest of India to keep the army as a whole intact? Then I really began to put on my thinking cap, and I said, sir, the thing is that it would be a little odd that the country would be partitioned, civil administration would be partitioned, and the partition, an army would be an Indian army of occupation in both the countries, in India and Pakistan. I couldn't see any future for that. So again, he directly asked me, would I volunteer to go to India? I said, certainly not. He asked me why, for the simple question, why? I said, for the simple reason that for the first time, when I became disgusted with the philosophy of India, was when the Indian National Army was raised by the Japanese and the Hindu troops en bloc joined the Japanese. And then later on, the Indian Congress, and today will be the government of India, of the partition, was supporting them. I couldn't possibly bring my mind, bring myself to adhere to that kind of philosophy. Either one is on one side, or one is on the other side. So they began enough to sing, thank me for my views, and I got up half shaking and left his presence. And when my CEO was waiting outside for me, as we were driving to the club for our 11s, I turned out to him and said, why the hell did he put me in that position? He said, what did I say? I said, all the things which I should have said and I shouldn't have said. That's period. So that was my idea party. Then we discovered that in the Indian Army, apart from the Gorkha regiments, the Gurkha regiments were first Gurkha, second Gurkha, third, fourth, fifth, and right up to about 9, 10 Gurkhas. There were Indian Army units from number 1 to regiment to 17. First Punjab, second Punjab, third was disbanded sometime, never existed. Fourth Bombay Grenadiers, fifth Maratha Light Infantry, sixth Rajputana Rifles, seventh Rajputs, eighth Punjab, ninth Jats, 10th Baluch Regiment, 11th Sikhs, 12th 24th, so on and so forth to the 17th Dogras. Among all these regiments, there were one class Hindu battalions and Sikh battalions. While the eight regiments from the first Punjab, barring 6th and 7th Rajputs and Rajputana Rifles, up to the 15th Punjab came to Pakistan. There were 8 regiments. In each regiment, there were 5 battalions of that group. 1st 8th Punjab, 2nd 8th Punjab, 1st 10th Baluch, 2nd 10th, and so on and so forth. Among all these, there were 50% Hindu elements, Hindu and Sikh, and 50% were Muslim, Punjabis and Pathans. Barring in my regiment, Baluch regiment, where there were 3 companies of Muslims, 2 Punjabi, 1 Pathan, and 1 company of Dogras. So when these 8 regiments came to Pakistan's share, they were 50% strength, except the Baluch regiment. While in India, the regiments went to India, there were battalions who had 50% strength of Muslims and Hindus. 11 Sikhs, Rajputana Rifles, 17 Dogras, 11 Sikhs, they were all one class battalions. There's Hindus or Sikhs. So we were at a disadvantage there. Well, population-wise, India was much more populated. So that was not a very good problem. Our area was smaller, our population was smaller. But where the crunch took place was that all our shares in India were not given to us. But partition took place in such a quick hurry, thanks to Lord Mountbatten and the Labour government then in England, that they said, have it at all costs. And they did it without a thought for dividing the assets. Assets meant money, assets meant the equipment which the army was using, equipment of the army, all the industries. There was not a single industry in Pakistan which could turn out a catapulty one, leave alone a rifle. And like this, we were taken at a disadvantage. All the industries, like textiles and machinery, were left in India. So we were in a terrible position. The banks, the foreign banks like Grinley's and Lloyd's Bank, plus the Imperial Bank of India, plus the National Bank of India. These banks who were operating in Pakistan, they did not have a single Muslim clerk, bank clerk, or cashier, or a manager, assistant manager. So when they dropped their pens and left for India at the time of partition, the banks closed down. Economy came to a standstill. Army, whatever equipment we had, these 8 regiments, and a few artillery regiments, they had. And beyond that, they had nothing. No reserves, nothing of the sort. That was 15th of August. Officers were without typewriters. If the typewriters were there, there were no typists. Mostly the teachers were Hindus. Hindu teachers left, Muslim schools are left with no teachers. So that was completely paralyzing period for Pakistan. Into the bargain, Kashmir war started. I will not go into the Kashmir, the pros and cons of it, but suffice it to say, Kashmir war thrust down our throats, and we were completely taken at a disadvantage. But the Pathan tribesmen went there and they fought. Some of us volunteered to go fight there. I also volunteered. I went to fight, but I went to Gilgit area, where I got the Gilgitis were there. So it was a very, very sad experience. Two civilized people who were practically one for centuries, whether the Muslims were ruling Hindus or not, whether the British were ruling or not, leaving that aside, we had a lot of things in common. We gave them a common language, the Muslim invasions from 10 centuries onwards. We gave them an Urdu language, which became a lingua franca. Among the 200 different languages and dialects in India, Urdu became a lingua franca. While in Pakistan, we had Pashto and Punjabi and Urdu and Baluchi. But still, we had a lot of things in common. We shared many things together. But when suddenly we found ourselves alone, and with tremendous enmity, the massacres that took place is absolutely a part of a different history.
Did you witness any of the killings?
Oh yes, in Deir Khan, which was majority Muslims, they were killing the Hindus in my battalion, and my company went and defended them. I got the Hindus out. And in fact, we beat all the Muslims practically to pulp to save the Hindus. And then my company in 1948, when we moved from Razmak to Karachi, there I was responsible for my company was given a sector in Karachi with my battalion. And we protect the Hindus there. It was done very, very fairly. But the refugees coming from India, they were massacred on the way. The Hindus which left by trains to India, there were also a couple of massacres took place, but not very many at that scale. But they did take place.
Can you tell me about how you came to volunteer to go to Gilgit in 1948?
Yes. My battalion was in there, in Karachi then. For the first time, I felt comfortable and free from fighting in war since 1940. Karachi was a town, up-and-coming town. Partition had taken place. Embassies were opening up in Karachi. My battalion was there. We had a band. There was a whole brigade there. We had every battalion had their own bands. We were invited to, our bands were hired to play at various functions. And there were parties galore. I mean, all the things which a young officer needed, we had there.